Hello, coastal people. Charlie Connolly here. Beavering away at the moment on the forthcoming Series 3 of Coastal Stories. Plenty of great tales from around the coasts of Britain and Ireland coming up, served just the way you like them, or something. In the meantime, though, something a little bit different. A two-part story of three people. I'm calling it Atlantic Stories. Three very different people making three very different stowaway journeys in the year 1928. Slightly longer than the usual stories. Don't worry, Coastal Stories will be back in its usual form. But in the meantime, here is part one of Atlantic Stories, with part two following right behind. It wasn't exactly comfortable among the mailbags, but Clarence Terhune knew he wouldn't be there for long. All the 19-year-old had to do was wait until it was impossible for them to turn back. Another couple of hours, and he could climb out from among the sacks that were driving him mad with the itching, and make himself known. He couldn't predict what would happen then, but they wouldn't throw him over the side at least. He'd jumped a few boxcars before, he'd stowed away on ships before, but this was on a different level. His stomach turned over with nervous excitement. Betty Simpson was a long way from home. She sat on a wooden bench outside the courtroom at Winchester Assizes and prepared herself for what was to come. She had her story ready. She wasn't sure the judge would buy it. But if she told it right, there was a good chance she could charm her way out of trouble through sheer force of personality, just as she'd done so many times before. A door opened. A policeman's head appeared around it. It was time. She smoothed the front of her skirt, stood up, and switched on a beaming smile. The clack of her heels echoed round the corridor. Vincenzo Basti had played a long game, and it was about to pay off. He could tell by the sound of the engines that the ship was about to dock. He looked through the spy hole and the last passengers were draining their coffee cups and heading back to their cabins. The waiting staff collected the crockery for the last time on this, the ship's maiden voyage. 7 years of planning, and nobody had suspected a thing. Just a few more hours, and all that patience, all that ingenuity, was about to pay off. 1928 was quite a year for stowaways, and New York in particular was busy with them. Between July 1927 and May 1928, 500 stowaways were sent to Ellis Island for deportation, and they were just the ones that got caught. Most were your standard hide in the forecastle or nip into a lifeboat and close the tarpaulin over you type. Some would try and stay hidden for the whole voyage, others would wait until the vessel was well out to sea, then present themselves to the crew, hoping to work their passage. A few showed a bit more imagination. In May, the Hamburg America liner Cleveland arrived at Pier 84 on the Hudson River by 44th Street in New York. When the cargo was being unloaded, an arm was seen to emerge briefly from a flap in a wooden box as it thumped onto the quayside. When the box was opened, port officials, hearing a dead body, instead discovered 20-year-old Johannes Thurnig from Duisburg in Germany. He'd posted himself, cash on delivery and labelled household goods, to a fictitious New York address. He had a passport and a visa, one of the lucky few that year to make the quota of Italians allowed into America. The only thing he didn't have was the fare for the voyage. Instead, he found a large crate, packed in enough water, sausage and chocolate to last the journey, some straw to make things a little less uncomfortable, had himself nailed inside and sent aboard the Cleveland. After crossing the Atlantic, just another few hundred yards out of the port, and he'd have made it. While many stowaways were, like Johannes, poverty-stricken Europeans seeking a new life, some were just adventurers, publicity seekers, and natural-born itinerants. It could be a dangerous business, though. In 1928 alone, a group of Italian stowaways were killed when a cargo of coal slipped in the hold where they were hiding and smothered them all. Another stowaway was found burned to death, having hidden too close to the base of the funnel. Others starved to death. More were asphyxiated when the holds of cargo ships were fumigated after unloading. A stowaway boom was kind of inevitable during the 1920s. More vessels than ever before were crisscrossing the oceans. Security was lax at ports, and crews changed personnel so quickly it was normal to see new faces going up and down gangplanks. Economic inequality meant more and more people were seeking new lives in places of greater opportunity, many of them without the means to actually get there. After the trauma of the First World War, a generation emerged determined to take life by the scruff of the neck. 4 years of mass slaughter had shown how fleeting life could be, so why not wring every ounce from it while you could? Stowing away was a cheap and thrilling way to see the world. It could also be a means of escape. The sea was an attractive way to put distance between a person and their trauma. The North Atlantic in particular had always been a conduit of secrets, an ocean to absorb the loneliness of pain. Clarence Terhune, hiding among the mailbags, might have only been 19 in 1928, but he was already a committed itinerant. At 14, he'd hopped a freight train from his home in St. Louis, Missouri, to see the Kentucky Derby. 2 years later, in 1925, he rode the boxcars to Seattle and stowed away aboard the steamer Alameda for Nome, Alaska, where he hoped to find some work. He presented himself to the crew after departure and cheerfully washed dishes all the way up the Pacific coast. But when they arrived, he found his timing was a little bit off. Nome was closing down for the winter. Everyone was leaving. Sheepishly, he found himself reboarding the Alameda, plunging his red raw hands into more scalding, soapy water. In November 1927, Clarence stowed away on the Malolo as it sailed from San Francisco to Hawaii. Then he stowed away on the way back. The crew weren't exactly pleased to see him again, to say the least, and put him to work as a deckhand. Very hard work as a deckhand. When he wasn't secreting himself in the fuggy hold of some oily old steamer, Clarence was riding boxcars across America, and whenever he needed money, he'd head for the nearest golf course and work as a caddy. In October 1928, Clarence was caddying at the Rye Country Club in Westchester, New York, when he heard about the Graf Zeppelin. ...800 feet long, carrying 36 crew and 24 passengers, it was, at the time, the largest airship ever constructed, and had just made its first Atlantic crossing from Friedrichshafen to the Lakehurst Naval Station in New Jersey. And soon, it would be going back to Germany. And New Jersey wasn't all that far from Westchester, and an idea began to form in Clarence's head. This wasn't Betty Simpson's first court appearance, although it was the first time the 25-year-old American had been up before the beak in England. She was, she said, an old hand at the itinerant life. She would introduce herself as the Queen of the Hobos. The previous year, she'd sailed as a stowaway on the Hamburg from New York to Bremerhaven and back, relying purely on her wits and the kindness of strangers. Then she'd hitched across America from New York to San Francisco and snuck aboard the Matsonia, planning to make her way first to Hawaii and then on to China. Unfortunately, her usually reliable smile hadn't worked on the captain of the Matsonia, and 3 days into the voyage, she was transferred by rowing boat to the President Polk, passing on its way from Honolulu to San Francisco. The Queen of the Hobos was arrested on arrival and charged with vagrancy. Appearing before Judge Sylvain J. Lazarus, Betty breezed into the dock and switched on the charm. "Good morning, Judge," she began. "I'm Betty Simpson from Texas. I'm Queen of the Hobos, and I stowed away on the Matsonia and got within a day of Hula Hula Land, and they shipped me to the President Polk and brought me back again, and now they've arrested me for vagrancy. It's a dirty shame, ain't it, Judge? Only I got to meet you, of course, and I'm tickled to death to do that. Now the question is, what you going to do about it?" "So you're a hobo, are you?" sighed the judge. "Yeah, and I'm a lady, see? Look me over." Betty did a twirl in the dock. After a little more of this unconventional back and forth, Judge Lazarus dismissed the case, at which point Betty insisted on posing for a photograph with the crusty old magistrate. A hint of a weary smile played at the corners of his mouth next to Betty's beaming face. On the steps of the courthouse, Betty told the assembled press she was from Brownsville, Texas, and had been on the road since leaving her father's farm in 1924, and leaving a string of laundry items across the country in the meantime. "I left a dandy silk shirt in a laundry in Tucson," she said. "Up in Toronto, they've got a pair of my best whatchamacallums, and down in Juarez, Mexico, well, I won't go into details." She was writing a book about her adventures, she told the reporters, and she was travelling looking for her ideal man. "Put that in big type in your paper," she said. "If he's here in San Francisco, I'll take him. He must be Irish, not less than 5'8", have dark hair and blue eyes, and prove that he can love me more than anyone else in the world." Vincenzo Basti was 29 in 1928, from Ortona on the east coast of Italy, a few miles south of Pescara. Ever since his teens, he dreamed of making it to America, but the quota system thwarted him. Introduced to limit the numbers of Italians allowed into the US after the mass immigration in the years before the First World War, this waiting list meant it could be a decade or more before Vincenzo fulfilled his emigrant ambitions. A decade. He'd be pushing middle age by then. It was supposed to be a new start, the beginning of the life he felt he was meant to live. Vincenzo was a patient man, but not that patient. So he decided to do something about it. He trained as a carpenter, then moved across the country to Naples, securing a job in a shipyard. In 1927, the yard won the contract to build a transatlantic liner called the Conte Grande, and once the sea trials had been completed, Vincenzo was assigned to work on the sumptuous interiors. He was responsible for making and installing wooden panelling of the highest quality in the cabins and saloons. It was a chance to really show off his skills, and it was the opportunity Vincenzo had been waiting for. He knew there would be a space between the panelling and the ship's hull, and he had the access and the skills to work that space to his advantage. Between the wood panels of the first-class dining lounge and the riveted steel of the hull was a space around 3 feet wide and 15 feet long. That, thought Vincenzo, would be more than enough. When he'd stay late after the other fitters had left, his colleagues ranged between admiring his conscientiousness and thinking he was nuts, because there was no overtime. What they didn't realise was that Vincenzo was working for himself, constructing a long, narrow cabin in which he could hide for the duration of the ship's maiden voyage to New York. He made a cot to sleep in with a mattress and bedding. He built himself a chair to sit in, and even wired in a lamp that he could read by. He smuggled in the few personal possessions he'd need to start a new life in America, and enough supplies to last the crossing. Cold meats, cheese, crackers, bottles of water, even a few bottles of Chianti. He drilled tiny holes in the panelling for ventilation, careful to hide them among the detail of the carving, and a larger one through which he could see what was going on in the saloon. And then everything was ready. When the ship was launched with great ceremony, Vincenzo's colleagues were surprised not to see him on the quayside. He'd put in more hours than most, after all. The next day the ship sailed for Genoa to pick up its first complement of passengers, and then set out across the Mediterranean, through the Straits of Gibraltar, and into the Atlantic. Next stop, New York. The ship fitters of the Naples Yard were assigned to different projects. A few of them noticed Vincenzo wasn't around, but just assumed he was working on another ship. Which he was, in a way. During the evening of October the 27th, 1928, the airship Graf Zeppelin was towed, slowly and tail first, out of its hangar at the Naval Air Station in Lakehurst, New Jersey. In a few hours, it would set out for Friedrichshafen to complete its return journey between Germany and the United States. Its crew of 36, under the command of Dr. Hugo Eckener, was responsible for 24 passengers, a small amount of cargo, including a bale of cotton and two typewriters, and 32 bags of mail. The passengers boarded the gondola and were shown to their cabins. Then at 1 o'clock in the morning, the giant airship was released from its moorings and eased gracefully away into the night. The Zeppelin headed south to pass over Lower Manhattan, where the ships on the Hudson River sounded their whistles and their sirens. A searchlight placed on the roof of a Brooklyn hotel traced the outline of the giant vessel in the sky, and, despite the lateness of the hour, crowds lined the streets, craning their necks to see the vast, shadowy presence above, picked out in the beam of the searchlight. Hidden among the mailbags, Clarence Terhune heard the commotion below and guessed what was happening. He'd have to stay put a little longer than he'd hoped for, but once the Zeppelin was out over the Atlantic, he could finally escape his hiding place. No matter how uncomfortable he was, no matter how itchy and sweaty it was getting among the sacks, he was darned if he was being sent back now. Clarence had saved $50, which he hoped would be enough to tide him over during whatever came next. He'd been cagey about revealing his plans, telling nice Mrs. Donnelly, with whom he'd been lodging, that he wanted to keep his room, but he might not be back for a while. Clarence hitched a ride to New Jersey, and found it surprisingly easy to enter the hangar at the naval base. He even found an unattended storeroom, in which he spent the night of the 26th of October, ready to board the airship as soon as he saw his chance the following day. The mail chute looked to be the best option, he thought, and sure enough, when the man standing guard walked away for a few minutes, Clarence scampered across the hangar, hauled himself up the chute, and hid among the sacks. All he could do now was wait. Betty Simpson's story didn't add up, and the magistrate saw through it almost immediately. She might have charmed that judge in San Francisco the previous year, but this was a different country and a different system. Back then, Judge Lazarus had admired her spirit, her resilience, even her charm, recognising something intrinsically American in her adventurousness, something he felt didn't deserve to be punished. Hampshire, in rural England, was a different matter. Betty knew her story broke down under the slightest scrutiny. She told the magistrate that she had gone to the pier at New York to see off two men she knew, passengers on the Cunard liner Aquitania bound for Southampton. They'd insisted she come aboard for a farewell drink. Then there was another drink, and then there were a few more drinks. The next thing she knew, it was the next day, and she was waking up on a sun lounger with a terrible headache, and the equally terrible realisation the ship had sailed with her still on board. If she delivered the story with a smile and enough panache, maybe, just maybe, she might get away with it. Unfortunately, the man from Cunard was one of the few she'd met on her travels who had the measure of Betty Simpson. He pointed out that this was the fourth time Miss Simpson had been caught on board a vessel without having paid her fare. "Her means of livelihood are those of a stowaway," he informed the judge. "She has no other means." He also wondered why, if she was just seeing off a couple of friends, friends who she had failed to identify among the passengers, why did she have a parcel with her containing a change of clothes and some toiletries? And why, he wondered, did she have a supply of postcards of herself, wearing a Mexican sombrero with the caption, "Betty Simpson, all around the world," that she'd been hawking to the Aquitania's paying passengers? Americans might have appreciated the sense of adventure, the chutzpah that Betty displayed, but there was none of that appreciation on display in Winchester on August the 8th, 1928. "We shall stop your little escapades," said the magistrate, and sentenced Betty to 4 weeks in prison. Vincenzo Basti had everything he needed in his bespoke compartment between the hull of the Conte Grande and the panelling of the first-class dining room. The rhythms of his day were set by the rhythms of the saloon. He'd breakfast when the passengers breakfasted, had lunch when they did, and his evening meal when they did too, even allowing himself a glass of Chianti with his cheese and crackers. He had a few books with him, so the hours passed pleasantly enough. Sometimes he'd have a look through his spy-hole and watch the waiters filling crystal goblets with wine, the men in their tuxedos, the women in their finest outfits. One day, he thought, when he'd made his fortune in America, he would book passage on the Conte Grande and dine in that very saloon, and he'd raise a glass of champagne in the direction of his hideaway. So carefully planned and so meticulously constructed, it was likely no one would ever find it until the ship came to be scrapped. Three people, three stowaways, three deeply contrasting stories. Three sets of hopes and dreams casting out into the Atlantic Ocean. Two of them had secrets. One of them just nurtured an ambition. You can find out which was which in part two of Atlantic Stories, brought to you by Coastal Stories. I'm Charlie Conway.